This is Jan Hocken, and I'm talking today with Jose Padin, a Puerto Rican teacher and scholar and faculty member in the sociology department at Portland State University. Padin is also a member of Portland Workers' Rights Board and a member of PSU faculty and staff for Justice in Palestine. Well, Jose, welcome to KBOO and the Olmo Variety Hour.
Hi, Jan. Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, I'd like to start with the teach-in at PSU on April 29th, organized by PSU's chapter of Super, Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, and a number of PSU faculty members with PSU Faculty and Staff for Justice in Palestine also participated. In your talk, you emphasized the importance of thinking through tactics in social movements, in particular in terms of their inclusiveness and the way that action should communicate something of the meaning or aims of the movement. What were you trying to convey to student activists?
A little bit of reflection around tactics and a little bit of reflection around the importance of communicating what you're doing. The whole issue of tactics is obviously a different matter depending on whether you belong to the part with more or less power. If you're working to stop the mass killing, the ethnic cleansing, the occupation of Palestine, you're clearly the party with by far the least power. So one of your aims is going to have to be to build people power. I mean, let's just put it bluntly. U.S. interest in the Middle East, U.S. imperialism, the State of Israel, and here we are on a campus or in a city street. So in the U.S., it is people power to stop the military funding and arming of Israel, for example. So to build people power, you need to bring more people into the movement, not fewer, more. So your tactics can be divided into those that bring more people into the movement or those that reduce the support for your cause. That's what I mean by inclusiveness when I use that term. I mean, to grow the movement, which involves bringing new people in, and there's a long, long way to go here, those people need to understand what your aims are and why they are desirable, urgent, just, etc. That seems elementary, but it is often neglected. And if you don't explain those things clearly, others will explain them for you, and chances are it will be your opponent who explains those things. We don't explain our aims clearly, then your aims can be explained as just you want to create trouble, or you can be accused of things such as anti-Semitism, for example, or being anti-American. We need to explain ourselves. You need to explain yourself with coherence, with clarity, and persuasively. And that applies both to explaining the aims and explaining methods. Now, coherence is more complicated than it would seem, but I think it's really important to break it down. I think there's three types of coherence that our stories need to have. One is logical coherence. Just cause effect, okay? Especially pertinent in relation to the methods or tactics we use. In other words, what you are doing connects in a reasonable way with this other outcome. The second one is ethical coherence. And a third one, not to be minimized, because we're trying to connect with people to grow a movement that are outside our circle, is common sense coherence. We need to understand what the common sense of people is and how it works to speak to that as well.
Yeah, there's also, I don't know how this principle would fit with what you've outlined, but there's a long tradition of prefigurative politics in the left where the relationships you form, the ways you come together and confront forces far more powerful than you and your group need to reflect something of the society you anticipate. So the role of nonviolence, the role of a democratic process for decision making, forms of nurture and care that are part of coming together in a protest action. So would you include that idea of prefigurative politics, the relationships that form or build through a movement and organizing?
Yeah, that's really important. What you're describing as prefigurative politics is what I have in mind when I just say ethical coherence. So when I evaluate my methods, can I, in a common sense way, communicate to people at large that aren't part of the movement that not only what we're aiming to accomplish, but how we're doing it actually prefigures kind of the type of relationships we want to have? I think that naturally, if they don't, if our methods don't seem appealing from that standpoint, okay, we're tripping ourselves over, we're getting in our ways, where it is just tactically mistaken. If I just people won't trust that you either have the intentions you say you have or that you're the right person to follow to get there.
So I'd like to present the dilemma that unfolded that very day around what you're describing. I was there at the teach-in in part as a KBOO Press participant, and it was one of the most thoughtful, inspiring teach-ins in memory for me, and I've been to many over the decades. The level of participation, there was one aggressive heckler that one of the organizers kind of kept him engaged on the side, and a group of activists kind of encircled the speakers. They didn't shove him out or push him out, but they kind of sidelined him to keep the focus on why they were there. Later that day and evening, there was an occupation of the library, and cameras were everywhere. And then, of course, that became the dominating news story that unfolded over the week versus the important organizing and thoughtful actions that were less dramatic in earlier months of these campaigns on campus. So how do we deal with that as a movement? And this may take us into the different kinds of tactics and actions around the country, including the encampments that have been very organized and disciplined, but the press tends to descend on these places along with the police when there's visible action and not as much speaking.
Well, first of all, the point of direct action is that it be action and that it be visible as well if we're aiming to grow a movement, and we have to. I mean, when we look at the numbers, there's been an uptick over the last decade in general support for Palestinians, but it's still relatively low, very low in the United States. So, in order to move the needle politically, we need to grow the numbers substantially. So, our actions need to be public, not only direct, they need to be visible. All of that is important. Now, I have a sense that you want to examine or compare different types of direct and visible action.
Well, I think there's always a risk, including the occupation of the library, that is unlikely to stir sympathies by many in the community, including people in the Palestinian rights movement. The teach-in ended very publicly before the occupation took place. There were different groups, I think, vying for space on the park blocks, but you run the risk of course, separating the good protesters who are well behaved and law abiding from the so-called bad protesters in judging certain tactics that involve property damage, question of what is the role of violence, who decides or determines if an action is violent, what is the meaning of occupying a library? I mean, is that a particular place that communicates something? How would you interpret the occupation of the library, as an observer?
I mean, there's many levels to that, but the first thing that I think responsible direct action that communicates, that aims to communicate to a larger public and draw them in, needs to be responsible. And that means to me, it needs to take into account the impact it has on others. In particular, those other people who are either on your side or potentially on your side, and does that action hurt them in any way? Without bringing in yet the whole issue of property damage, just the occupation of a facility may have a negative impact on others. A library, for example, did you think it through? Did you take into account how it would impact them? I think those are important considerations.
Yeah, and I
That's
think the decision, and we don't know, and I think I would not want to speculate, and I assume you would not either, how the decision was made among activists, how many were involved in that decision to occupy the library. But I know that an important practice in left and feminist organizing, in my experience, is having a group that makes both a decision where you establish relationships of trust, whether you decide who's willing to get arrested if that's a decision, and who is at too much risk to put themselves in the position of getting arrested, how jail support is set up if that is a potential outcome, how to communicate what you're doing, which I think was very much part of an action where a group of activists got arrested in January. There was quite a bit of effort to communicate what they had done and how they had made that decision.
I have commonly heard the following justification around property destruction in a movement. And it says, lives can't be recovered, property can always be rebuilt. And that is absolutely true statement of fact. Now, I find it fairly irrelevant when it comes to deciding on whether or not a tactic is advisable. I
You're
don't think
getting to
it.
that idea of coherence and what one thing has to do with another.
Yeah, I don't think that's a coherent story when it comes to deciding on a tactic. And the reason is it is not logically coherent and it violates common sense. For a movement in the United States trying to stop the brutality of the Israeli action against Palestinians, there are only two examples I can think of that make property damage justifiable in a coherent way. One is the property that you're damaging in any material, actual material way protecting Palestinian people? It's hard to think of any instance of that here. If you have a way to disable or destroy an Israeli tank that is going to run over a Palestinian village, that is absolutely justifiable, I think. Okay.
Well, this doesn't involve property damage, but there's been a long-standing campaign organized by Super to cut for PSU to cut ties with Boeing. And I think out of the escalating actions and organizing, including the teach-in and students confronting the Board of Trustees at PSU, the president has offered to look again at that and is having a forum at Portland State looking at the arguments, which I think are very compelling for cutting ties with Boeing as a major defense contractor and supplier of arms to Israel. Now, the students have not been out there doing property damage at the Boeing facility at Gresham. And of course, they make commercial planes here, but it's the larger Boeing entity the students are protesting. But would this be an area where you might look differently at actions that were actually part of the previous anti-war movements, where actions here in Portland, there was a plan to bomb the ROTC building. And one of the faculty members in the philosophy department at Portland State served some time in prison around that allegations of his participation in that. So I think people understood then that the ROTC and campus recruiting was directly related to the Vietnam War.
Yeah, I think that's a different category altogether of property damage. You have that in the anti-war movement. You have that in also the present-day environmental movement, you know.
Yeah, but one of the costs of some of those tactics in the anti-war movement, including the Weather Underground, that use this line, bring the war back home, blowing up buildings, very careful to protect human life in those actions. But it alienated a lot of people. People do not want to bring their children, or families to events that have that kind of violence and to participate in it in ways that put a lot of people in risk, particularly those that are more vulnerable to the criminal justice system.
Yeah, that's true. In general, I think the test any tactic needs to pass is first of all, is it going to grow the movement? Second of all, is there a cause effect connection between the action you're taking and the liberation of Palestine? And I really can't think of any form of property damage in our midst, in practical terms, here in the United States, that would in any way materially contribute to that aim.
You've been referring to a number of historical moments, and particularly around tactics and ways of thinking about direct action as they communicate the aims and the purpose of a movement. In closing, are there other historical lessons you think are important to draw on?
Well, I think absolutely. This is what makes all of these movements so challenging. If I contrast them, for example, with the labor movement. The labor movement, if you're a labor activist and you come up in it, there's a continuity that generally you know what the options are. There's business unionism, there's organizing for collective bargaining inside the box. There is social movement unionism, class struggle unionism, and there is an awareness of the history behind each one of those tactics. And that history is passed on. When it comes to all other social movements, including this emerging one in support of the Palestinian people, we don't have that institutionalized memory, and we don't have the continuity of schools where you come up in there and you know what the tactics are. So the only other alternative we have is we have to sit back and study what has been successful in other times and other places by people who were trying to build people power to take on economic might or military might. And I don't see any other way around it, but at a great disadvantage compared to the movement of labor.
This movement now that has emerged, and it's not clear how far back to trace its history. It has a long history, even among student groups. I'm not sure how much of that has been transmitted, the Palestinian rights movement through student groups. But one of the lessons of history that you seem to be citing here is the connections between students and labor. All back in 68 and earlier periods, the anti-apartheid movement around South Africa, it seems that a critical part of movements has been alliances between student activists, student radicals, and more left-wing labor union members and activists. And that seems to be happening now with the International Longshore Workers Union, the Auto Workers Union. Can you speak to that as a labor activist locally as well?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think the logic of what makes labor movement strong and the logic of, say, the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and in the Palestinian Liberation Movement is the same logic. You build power in order to withdraw something of economic value. Workers withdraw their labor in mass numbers in order to move the employer class. Martin Luther King spoke about this really clearly in terms of the lessons that the civil rights movement, they said everything we did when it came to the boycotts, we learned from labor. It's the same principle. And then it requires organization and coordinated action. So in mass numbers, your withdrawal of economic support can weaken the powers that you want to influence. So there is learning between the civil rights movement and the labor movement that happened in the past, and I think boycott, divestment, and sanctions follows the same principle.
Well, thank you so much, Jose Padin, for joining us today as a scholar and also longtime activist, racial justice and labor activist. So I hope you come on the show again on the Olmol to reflect on where we're at, and it's both hopeful but worrisome times ahead.
Thank you, Jen, for having me here, and having this conversation. I hope it has some spin-offs in the community. These are things that need to be explored continuously by everyone who wants to be active.
Thanks so much, Jose Padin, for being with us today.